Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and week two of our series Reefer Managed continues now as the New York and New Jersey governors continue their efforts to legalize use and selling of the crop within the next few months. We're covering this topic with a segment each weekday from now until Friday, April 19th, and we'll conclude the series with a national call-in show at noon on Saturday, 4:20. Yesterday, we traced cannabis criminalization back to anti-immigrant sentiments after a wave of Mexican immigration to the United States after the Mexican Revolution in 1920. Now we turn to cannabis and mass incarceration, from Reagan-era policies to today. You may know the statistic by now. The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, but nearly 25% of its incarcerated population. And this, according to Michelle Alexander's seminal 2010 book, The New Jim Crow, is largely due to the war on drugs. Well, joining me now to discuss some of the history of the war on drugs and his personal experience as a former federal prosecutor is Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University and author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice, and most recently, Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Professor Butler, it's an honor. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, it's great to be back.
Can you give us a little background on yourself in this context first? You've described yourself as a soldier in the war on drugs. In what way were you that at one time?
I was a reluctant soldier. The only reason that I stopped smoking pot was because I became a prosecutor, and we got tested at the Department of Justice. So like a lot of people who talk about drugs, I was a hypocrite in a sense, because then I started a gig as a prosecutor where I put a lot of people, almost all of whom were young black men, in the criminal legal process for using drugs or selling drugs, including marijuana.
Would it be accurate to say, as a matter of history, that the war on drugs as we know it began in June of 1971 when President Richard Nixon declared drug abuse to be, quote, public enemy number one?
I think that we can locate where the war on drugs started at a number of places. As you've discussed, Brian, it's been all about race more than it's been about public health. I often say that we need to not talk about the legalization of drugs, but the re-legalization of drugs, because for most of the history of our country, it was legal to possess and sell most drugs. You could go into the equivalent of Walgreens and CVS back in the 1800s and buy opium. And the reason that opium was criminalized was there was a concern in California about quote-unquote Chinamen who were using opium to seduce white women. And so we got our first anti-drug law in California in the 1800s. And as you've done, Brian, you can go back and trace pretty much the criminalization of every drug after that with some concern about race. China men, quote unquote, African Americans, Mexican Americans. And so when the war on drugs was formally started by President Nixon, it was clear that it was not going to be a war that took its enemies in an objective sense. It was a war against black and brown people.
And if President Nixon started the modern war on drugs, President Ronald Reagan was certainly associated with its expansion. Let's take a listen to what Reagan thought of cannabis. Here's a clip of him on the campaign trail in 1980.
Leading medical researchers are coming to the conclusion that marijuana, pot, grass, whatever you want to call it, is probably the most dangerous drug in the United States, and we haven't begun to find out all of the ill effects, but they are permanent ill effects.
Wow, I could just hear our listeners snickering to hear him call it the most dangerous drug.
Especially because I'll bet that later that night he went to a fancy dinner where he probably consumed what everyone understands is the most dangerous drug, alcohol. So any way you measure destructiveness, you could talk about loss economic productivity. You could talk about dysfunctional families. You could talk about committing crimes under the influence of it. Alcohol is by far the worst drug. But we tried criminalizing that, and it just didn't work. What it created was this illegal market where people like Al Capone were basically drive-by shooters trying to control and regulate the market for alcohol. So even a lot of people who think that we ought to treat marijuana like we treat alcohol now, their argument isn't that there are no problems with allowing marijuana to be consumed. The idea is if we could regulate it, if it could be done in a transparent way in the sunshine, that we could deal with the public health issues better than making it illegal and driving everything underground.
Do you think that about any other drugs that might even be more controversial, cocaine or any kind of opioid?
I think that we need to think about public health rather than the criminal justice system to deal with those problems. Again, what I'm, as a prosecutor, interested in is equal justice under the law and equal protection under the law. And we know that when we look at the government statistics would say that African Americans don't use drugs any more than any other group. They don't sell drugs more than any other group. But if you look at who's locked up for that crime, the jails are full of black and brown people. And so what I said is when it comes to who gets locked up for using and selling drugs, what's good enough for white folks is good enough for people of color. And by and large, the vast majority of white people who use and sell drugs are undisturbed by the criminal law.
We should note for the sake of history that it wasn't a straight line from Nixon's war on drugs to Reagan declaring cannabis the most dangerous drug out there. We're actually going to replay a clip that we had on yesterday in a different context of President Jimmy Carter, who was between Nixon and Reagan and had a very different sentiment. This is 12 seconds of him in an address to Congress in 1977.
I support a change in law to end federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana, leaving the states free to adopt whatever laws they wish concerning marijuana.
So, Paul Butler, as you understand history, was there already a kind of liberal conservative divide on this? And I wonder if you think Carter had racial injustice in mind at all.
I wouldn't be surprised if he did. He was someone who had grown up in the South, was very aware of our history of segregation and unequal enforcement of laws, especially some of the drug laws. So there are so many reasons to understand that legalizing marijuana makes sense in terms of, again, dealing with the public health issue, allowing people who become addicts or kind of like alcoholics to not want to hide their addiction, but to seek out help. And understanding that the vast majority of people who use marijuana, just like the vast majority of people who use alcohol, are able to do it in a way that's about recreation. It's a way of, again, socializing. And so, especially if you consider the tax benefits that the 10 states that have now legalized recreational marijuana are enjoying, you know, a lot of concern goes into how much money goes into our criminal legal process, and what if, rather than spending all that money locking up people, we used it for stuff like public health or jobs training or making the schools better. Some of the states that have legalized marijuana and in turn reap these vast windfalls from taxing their sale, they're doing just that, Brian. They're putting that tax dollar to stuff that's in the public interest.
We're going to have a debate on the show on Friday, not between legalization and criminalization, but between legalization and decriminalization. Does that distinction matter, in your opinion, with respect to racial and criminal justice, the distinction between full legalization, where you can open cannabis stores and all that stuff, and decriminalization, where it's still technically illegal, but nobody's really going to get busted for it?
Nobody except black people and brown people. So the concern is that when police have this kind of discretion, they use it selectively against poor people, against people who live in the hood. And so if somebody on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, one of those fancy buildings, smells someone smoking something they shouldn't be smoking in public, again, that person could call the doorman or the super or one of the security guards. In an African American community, a Latinx community, it's the police who get called. And if the cop does get called in the Upper East Side, he says, kid, you know you shouldn't be doing that. Toss out that joint. The black kid gets arrested. And so there's just no way, based on history, that law enforcement, including police officers, are going to be able to treat African-Americans, Latinos, and white people the same way. So if they have that discretion, history tells us it's not going to be used in a way that creates equal justice for black and brown folks.
We are in our series, Reefer Managed, here on The Brian Lehrer Show, this week talking about criminal justice and marijuana laws. And today with Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown, author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice, and most recently, Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And we can take some of your phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Ed in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Paul Butler. Hi, Ed.
Yes, thank you, Brian. I had a question for the professor. I wanted to get his take on whether or not we should stop calling it the war on drugs. Now, terminology so often sets the terms, and as the professor correctly points out, the war on drugs was never a war on drugs. It's always been a war on black and brown people. And people can talk about the ineffectiveness of it and all these other just ridiculous ideas and notions when, well, you know, at the very least, we should call it the so-called war on drugs. But I think we need a different term for it as a war on black and brown people.
Great question, Ed. I think we're understanding that rhetoric matters, and how we describe issues often determines how we think about issues and where we come out. And so what a lot of prosecutors are talking about now is being smart on crime rather than being tough on crime. And I think when you're smart on crime, you understand that the answer to every social problem is not to find somebody to lock up and throw away the key, but to go to root causes, to think about how we got to this situation, where if you're a black man in your 40s and you don't have a high school degree, you're more likely to be incarcerated than you are to have a job. And so being smart on crime also recognizes that, yeah, the war on drugs, that's not the best way to deal with the issues that legalizing some drugs like marijuana with the potential of that legalization.
And Ed, thank you for your call. This is how far it can go, and obviously you're familiar with this. Maybe our listeners who may know these names from the news of people who have lost their lives may not realize the connection with marijuana. The officer who fatally shot Philando Castile during a traffic stop told investigators that the smell of, quote, burnt marijuana was there. North Carolina police officers decided to confront Keith Lamont Scott after observing him smoking cannabis in his car. Michael Brown, Marley Graham, Sandra Bland have similar stories. And so as a former federal prosecutor, how does law enforcement see cannabis use as a justification even for fatal violence?
You know, one of the concerns about the number of people who have been shot and killed by police officers in circumstances in which the officers didn't need to use deadly force. One way to think about reforming the discretion that allows police officers to be in that situation is to reduce contacts between the police and the communities they patrol, and especially to reduce the kinds of contacts that lead to those situations. And so, yes, Brian, a lot of times police officers will claim that they saw someone smoking what they thought was marijuana because it was a blunt. Now, mind you, a blunt is just a cigar that's been hollowed out and the tobacco removed and marijuana put in. But from a distance, it looks like a cigar. So if a young black or Latinx man is smoking a regular cigar in his car, that gives the police a reason to go, to look, to see what they can see, and to have a contact with a citizen that's almost inevitably going to be unpleasant. And so one of the benefits, if you will, of legalizing marijuana is that it reduces those negative interactions between the police and the communities that they are supposed to serve and protect.
And I wonder, I can only wonder if there are statistics for that, because obviously the police didn't shoot any of those people who were famously killed in very controversial police shootings just because they had cannabis. But I wonder how many contact incidents, as you call it, as many people call it, you know, the initial contact spurred by that wound up very badly.
You know, that just doesn't only go to marijuana. So the police originally stopped Eric Garner in Staten Island for the crime of selling a tobacco cigarette in a park in Staten Island. And Michael Brown in Ferguson was originally stopped for walking on the roadway, that is, jaywalking. So one of the reforms that prosecutors who are smart on crime are thinking about is reducing the number of petty crimes that you could be arrested for. So we were talking about decriminalization before, and instances like jaywalking, a ticket, rather than arresting someone and saddling them with a criminal record for the rest of their life. That's being smart on crime.
Jay in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Paul Butler. Hi, Jay.
Hey, how you doing, sir? I love your show. Always listen.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the call. I have a question. I'm an African-American fairly young person who's a landlord in Brooklyn, and I just don't see anybody talking about the fact that a lot of times with some of the arrests, or it seems like a lot of the concentration of the arrests happen around not just the drugs, but also some of the violence that actually goes along with the drugs, like, you know what happens with some of the people there versus, say, you're on the Upper East Side smoking weed where you're in a project in Brooklyn, it's a completely different thing. And unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of times a criminal aspect or a more violent aspect in some of the tougher neighborhoods that drugs are connected to, which is not always the case in these affluent neighborhoods. And do you ever think, you think there's any validity to this at all?
Paul, you got the question?
Yeah, so based on the science, and again, we're thinking about being smarter in crime and not being having our criminal justice policy driven by stereotypes, especially stereotypes about people who live in black and brown communities. What the science tells us is that, you know, most folks who smoke some weed, they want to break open a big box of Cheetos. They don't want to get into a fight. And again, if the argument is that some drugs make you more disposed to commit a crime, and that's a reason to make possessing that drug a crime, the first drug we're going to lock up people for is alcohol. About 50% of people who commit homicide are under the influence not of weed or cocaine or heroin. They're under the influence of alcohol. And the New York Times did a wonderful study that kind of goes directly to the question that Jay just asked. So if you look at the paper from May 13th of last year, the question was, is the fact that so many more black people get arrested for weed in New York City, is it because they live in more dangerous neighborhoods, and that's where the cops are? And that's part of the reason, but it's not the whole reason. So even when the New York Times is really good study, they control for, like, the dangerousness of the neighborhood or where cops get the most 911 calls from, you still see the selective discrimination, especially against African Americans. And so, again, I don't think that there's any reason to think that black folks are more likely to get in fights or commit a violent crime under the influence of marijuana than anybody else. The fact is, it doesn't happen a lot with any group, and it sure doesn't happen more with African Americans than it does with other folks.
And Jay, thank you for your call. So, Paul, we have 45 seconds left, and I'm going to use a little host license here to veer from the topic at hand, because I've watched you on television so much over the last year talking about the Mueller investigation. investigation. Can you just give me a quick thought on if, and if so, how much you were shocked by the fact that Mueller did not indict Donald Trump or Donald Trump Jr. for anything?
Well, we knew that because Mueller's a company man. He was going to follow DOJ policy and not actually indict a sitting president. Again, that's not required by the Constitution, but it's in the DOJ employee's handbook. We still don't know what he found about obstruction and the president. We can assume that he found considerable evidence that the president did obstruct justice, which is why he was not able to exonerate him. And I'm very concerned about Bill Barr, the now Attorney General, being able to make the decision about how much of the report the American people get to see. Because we know that he's been biased from the beginning. He did a memo before he got the job where he said that the president can't commit obstruction. And so in the interest of transparency and accountability, we need somebody other than Barr to make these decisions.
Jump in. Paul Butler, who is the author most recently of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Thank you so much for being part of our Reefer Managed series.